Ever wonder if an agreement attached to land is really as permanent as it seems? You know, those ones that seem like they'll just stick around forever.
Yeah, I know what you mean, like those covenants you see that are supposed to bind everyone who comes after.
Exactly. We're going to unpack a North Carolina case today. Mid-South Gulf v. Fairfield Harborside. It really gets into those critical differences between covenants that actually bind future landowners and those that, well, don't. Think of it like a cheat sheet to understand what truly makes an obligation related to land stick.
I think a lot of students struggle with that running with the land concept, figuring out when an obligation actually goes beyond the initial folks who made the deal.
Yeah, for sure. And in our deep dive today, we're specifically asking, is a covenant that requires timeshare owners to shell out more for amenities something that can be enforced against, you know, later owners who come along?
Oh, that's a good one. I mean, these kind of disputes pop up all the time, right? Especially in places with planned communities or like developments that have these shared resources. Everyone wants to know who foots the bill and for how long. And this case gives us some pretty valuable clues.
Absolutely. We're talking about a situation that went on for decades, dealing with fees for recreational amenities. And get this, a whole lot of cash on the line. We're talking about $1.8 million.
Whoa, okay, so the stakes are high. So where do we even begin with this? What was the initial deal about these amenity fees?
Okay, so the starting point here is 1979, the Master Declaration for Fairfield Harbor, basically the ground rules. And it laid out these covenants, right? Requiring property owners to pay these yearly amenity fees, you know, to keep the recreational stuff up and running.
Makes sense. Got to keep those pools clean and the tennis courts in good shape. But I'm guessing things got a little messy somewhere down the line.
Oh, yeah. Here's where it gets interesting. Fast forward to 1993. The original developer decides to sell the recreational facilities. They hand them off to this separate company, Harbor Recreation Club, HRC for short.
Okay, so new owners, new rules maybe?
Kind of. Along with the sale came, like, these brand new covenants. And get this, these new covenants, they slapped timeshare owners with much higher amenity fees. We're talking up to 5.56 times the base rate.
Whoa, hold on. Five times higher. That's quite a jump. Why such a huge difference for timeshare owners specifically?
Honestly, it's not totally crystal clear from what we've got, but it definitely sets the stage for, you know, the legal showdown later. Now, there was this little side story in 98, some disagreements, a settlement popped up.
Yeah.
For a bit, it capped those timeshare fees, brought them down to the same level as regular owners.
Ah, so a temporary truce in the fee wars.
Yeah, exactly. But here's the thing, that settlement, totally irrelevant to the transactions that really matter in the lawsuit.
Interesting. So kind of a historical footnote.
Exactly. It shows there was some back and forth, but doesn't directly affect the legal arguments we're focused on.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so then in 99, HRC decides to sell those recreational amenities again.
Yeah.
This time to Mid-South Gulf. They become the plaintiff in our case.
Okay.
This sale, it specifically mentioned those 1993 covenants.
Right.
The ones with the higher timeshare fees. No mention of that 98 settlement, though.
Gotcha. So Mid-South Gulf steps in. They inherit these covenants saying, hey, timeshare folks, gotta pay more. What happened next?
Well, for a few years, from 2000 to 2004, the timeshare associations, there are defendants, they kept paying those fees.
Yeah.
But at the same rate as the regular owners. Maybe they were still honoring that old settlement. Or maybe Mid-South just wasn't enforcing those higher fees yet. Who knows?
Okay.
But then, boom, 2004, Mid-South decides to enforce those higher fees, you know, based on those 1993 covenants. And naturally, they sue the timeshare associations for a boatload of unpaid fees. Over $1.8 million, remember.
So that's where the real legal battle begins.
You got it. And like we said at the beginning, it all boils down to one crucial question. Is this obligation to pay those higher fees a real covenant? Or is it a personal covenant?
Okay, time for a little property law 101. What's the difference between those two?
Right, let's break it down.
So a real covenant, that's the kind that sticks with the land. It's not just between the original people who signed it. It binds everyone who owns that property later on, too. It's it becomes part of the land itself.
Okay.
Then you've got personal covenants. They're just agreements between the original parties. They don't automatically apply to future owners.
So in our case, if the court decided that the fee agreement was real, then those timeshare associations would be on the hook for those higher fees. But if it was personal, they wouldn't be bound by that later deal.
Exactly. And in North Carolina, there are certain rules for a covenant to be considered real. Like, did the original parties intend for it to run with the land? And something called privity of estate, which we won't get into today. But the big issue in Mid-South was whether the covenant touched and concerned the land.
Touched and concerned the land. Okay, that sounds important. What does that actually mean, though?
This is where property law gets super specific. Basically, for a covenant to touch and concern the land, it has to directly affect how the land can be used, its value, or how people enjoy it. It's got to be fundamentally connected to the property rights of that land. Think of it like this: a covenant that says what kinds of buildings you can put up, that's a clear example, it affects how you can use the land. Or, say, a rule about maintaining a shared road that everyone uses, that impacts access and how people enjoy their property.
Okay, starting to get the picture.
And, you know, it's not just about what people meant to do back then. This doctrine, it's like a safeguard, right? It stops landowners from just dumping a bunch of random obligations on people down the line, obligations that aren't even really about the land itself. It helps keep things clear and fair when it comes to owning property.
So the court had to figure out if requiring these higher fees for recreational stuff, which wasn't even on the timeshare property, actually had that direct impact.
Right. And they looked beyond just the words in the agreement. They focused on what the covenant actually did, what its effect was. And they decided the fee, it was basically just money. Sure, having access to the amenities might make the timeshares more appealing, but paying the fee itself, it wasn't directly tied to using the timeshare property or its value in the same way as those other examples we talked about.
Okay, so it wasn't as cut and dry as, say, a rule about what you could build. Our sources also mention this important distinction that the court makes: a license versus an easement. Why was that such a big deal?
Oh, that's crucial. So the timeshare owners, they had a revocable license to use the amenities. A license is basically permission to do something on someone else's land, right?
Hmm.
But the owner can take it back. It's not a permanent thing. It's not like a solid property, right?
So it's more like you're invited to a party, but the host can always ask you to leave.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Now compare that to an easement. That's a legal right to use someone's land for a very specific reason. Easements, they're much more permanent. They're a real interest in the land itself. And the court here, they emphasize this. Because the timeshare owners, they only had this license that could be revoked, they didn't have something solid like an easement. So the obligation to pay those fees, it wasn't seen as super connected to actually owning the timeshare. The right to use the amenities, gone, poof. But they'd still own their timeshare.
So the fact that it was just a license made the argument that the fee covenant touched and concerned the land much weaker.
Right. The court saw it as more like a personal contract, you know, like you're paying for a service, not something that really affects the land itself. And to back up their thinking, they looked at another case, Finley v. Higgs.
Oh, interesting. Tell me about that case.
So in Finley, the North Carolina Supreme Court had said that fees for off-site amenities, not touching and concerning the land, that earlier ruling was a big precedent, reinforcing the idea that you gotta have a much stronger, more direct link to the property itself. Something more like an easement that guarantees access, you know?
Okay, so Mid-South Gulf isn't some outlier decision. It fits into a bigger picture of property law in North Carolina. Now, our sources pull out some important quotes from the court's opinion. Let's look at them. First one: defendants merely have a revocable license to use the recreational amenities. The covenant does not touch and concern their properties.
That one really sums up the whole decision. They call out the revocable license. They're highlighting how temporary and not essential the right to use those amenities is. Just a license. Then the obligation to pay doesn't really impact the land itself. License gone. Owners still have their timeshares.
Got it. The second quote is, "The amenities are not appurtenant to the defendant's land. The fee is a personal obligation." What does appurtenant mean here, legally speaking?
Appurtenant in property law means something belongs to or is so closely tied to the land that it goes with the land when it changes hands. Think of a right-of-way, an easement for a specific property. That easement is appurtenant to that land.
I see.
Here, the court's saying, those amenities, not a necessary part of the timeshares, separate things, and the right to use them, based on that license, not on owning the land. So paying for them, that's a personal obligation between the people using them or the timeshare association and whoever's providing them, HRC and then Mid-South.
So the court sided with the timeshare associations, said they weren't bound by those higher fees. What does this all mean? What are the takeaways for people developing property and for our listeners who are going to be lawyers someday?
It's a big deal for developers, anyone writing covenants for these kinds of places. If you want a financial obligation to stick to the land, bind future owners, it's got to be clearly and directly tied to how that land is used, its value, how people enjoy it. You can't just write runs with the land and call it a day. What the obligation actually is, what it does, that's what matters. Got to have that touch and concern connection.
And for those future lawyers out there tuning in, why should they care about this touch and concern thing?
It's a limit on the power to create lasting obligations that are tied to land, right? It keeps people from getting stuck with a bunch of random fees and stuff that have nothing to do with their property. Imagine if any development could make covenants that force homeowners to pay forever for things that aren't even connected to their land. This doctrine, it's a safety net. It makes sure that when a covenant runs with the land, it's really about the land itself and what it means to own it.
Makes sense. Any quick exam tips for our listeners when they're dealing with covenants?
Here's the key question. Is the benefit or the burden of this covenant directly linked to the physical land, to how it's used or enjoyed? Or is it more like a financial deal for a service or membership somewhere? If it's more like paying for something, not affecting the property directly, chances are it doesn't touch and concern the land.
Love a good analogy to really nail things down. Got one for touch and concern.
Okay, picture this. A homeowners association rule that says how tall your house can be. That affects your land directly. It limits what you can build. Now imagine a fee you got to pay to support a business miles away, even if you get a discount. That second one. The connection to your land is way weaker. The first one touches and concerns your land. The second, not so much.
Crystal clear. So as we wrap up our deep dive, what's the big takeaway from Mid-South Golf?
Mid-South Golf shows us loud and clear that in North Carolina, if you want a covenant to bind future owners, it's got to be tied to the land itself in a real and tangible way. Can't just be about money or a license to use something separate. Got to have that touch and concern link.
It makes you think, right? With all these new ways of developing property, mixed-use places, fancy amenities, complicated ownership structures, will our old ideas about touch and concern still work? What new kinds of obligations will courts have to look at? Definitely something to ponder. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Until next time.